Yet for all this, his anger is not turned away, his hand is still upraised. From this chapter, the news left ringing in each of our ears is that the Lord, the God of Israel, is the God who brings judgment. But in each of our ears, is this bad news or good news? The person born in a cozy suburban home may recoil at this news. By contrast, the person born in the refugee camp or the war zone will rejoice at this news. The point being, you have to have lived a comfortable life to want a God who doesn't judge wickedness and injustice. At the beginning of our sermon series, back in chapter 6, we were brought in on Isaiah's vision of the Lord, high and exalted, seated as judge upon his throne. The floodgates of his judgment all but ready to burst open. The God of our imaginations is distant and unmoved by anything that goes on in this world. But the God revealed to us in Scripture draws near and is deeply moved by all he sees happening in his creation. He cares, and so he acts. He is the hands-on God. So we read, yet for all this, his anger is not turned away. His hand is still upraised. Here in Isaiah, we've been meeting the Lord who alone will be exalted. That being so, he must humble all other pretentious human powers. Why? So that they may be crushed at his feet? No. Across the sweep of Isaiah, we learn that just as the Lord is exalted and secure on high, so are all who turn and put their trust in him. That's important. There is only one way to rightly be high and exalted. That is by turning to the Lord, putting our trust in him, and letting him exalt us. Up until now, the focus of our series has mostly been upon the people of Judah, the house of David centered on Jerusalem. But in the verses we've just heard read, the focus has shifted to the people of Israel, the tribes who had broken away, centering their life on Samaria. Israel never intended it, but in conspiring to overthrow Judah, it was now a human power in opposition to the Lord. And you don't get more pretentious than that. The Lord alone will be exalted, and so Israel will be humbled. Notice how it starts out there in chapter 9, verse 9. Israel is lifted high in pridefulness. Follow the narrative through to chapter 10, verse 4. Israel has been brought low in helplessness. But it hasn't been plucked from the heights and brought down to the depths in one swoop. Instead, we see Israel being humbled more gradually through successive turns of a downward spiral. You see, it wasn't inevitable that the Lord's upraised arm would bring about their ruin. His anger is so different to our anger. This isn't the Lord losing control. This is him exercising perfect control to achieve his perfect purposes. So, at each turn of this downward spiral, he does only what is necessary to give Israel a wake-up call. His anger is directly proportionate. At each turn of this spiral, Israel receives no more than is necessary to stir them from their slumber. Yet there's stubbornness here at every turn. For all this, his anger is not turned away. His hand is still upraised. This hands on God. We all at times try our best to push his hand away. We'd prefer for him to be a hands-off God, but that option isn't open to any of us. The Lord has his hand upon each of our lives. The question you and I need to ask is whether his hand is upon us to lift up or to pull down, to exalt or to humble. Make no mistake, the Lord wants nothing more than to lift up. But if necessary, he will bring down. And often the only way to lift someone up is by first bringing them down. So, let's look together briefly at this downward spiral. The first turn of which begins there in verse 8. Israel considers itself to be high and exalted. Why such confidence? King Pekah and King Rezin have conspired together. Ephraim has allied itself with Aram, so they now consider themselves unassailable. Recent skirmishes with Judah have been at a cost. The bricks have fallen down, the fig trees have been felled, verse 10. Houses have been demolished, plantations have been destroyed, yet we'll recover from this, is the common assumption. However, pride and arrogance of heart mean they're not content simply to regain what was lost. The bricks have fallen down, but we will rebuild with dressed stone. The fig trees have been felled, but we will replace them with cedars. Do you see the move? From rough bricks to shiny dressed stone, from little fig trees to lofty cedars, this is the insatiable pursuit of still greater heights. What of us? The COVID pandemic these past 2 years was a great leveler, providing our moment for rethinking what matters most in life. It's a mistake to let such reset moments simply pass us by. But will we simply continue on in the same old pursuits, always chasing what's better and bigger? See there in verse 11 how the Lord intervenes in the face of such pride in Israel. The source of their confidence was their alliance with Aram, but the Lord has strengthened Rezin's foes against them and has spurred their enemies on. Aram is about to be removed from the world stage. Where then Israel's confidence for a prosperous future? Because of Israel's pride, the Lord will bring about their humiliation. Yet, for all this, his anger is not turned away. His hand is still upraised. So we move on to the second turn of this downward spiral, beginning there in verse 13. With the source of their false confidence cut off, it's now time for the source of Israel's confusion to be dealt with. Their own leaders are about to be cut off. Notice what is said about these in verse 16. Those who guide this people mislead them. To mislead is to deceive. It's to lead by giving people a partial and distorted picture instead of the full and accurate picture they need. We might assume then that Israel would be better off without such elders, dignitaries, and prophets, that there is a strange mercy here in the Lord removing these leaders. But not so fast. It isn't simply those doing the leading who were in the wrong. Verse 16 again. And those who are guided are led astray. To be led astray is to be led away from what is right. It's to find yourself immersed more and more deeply in what is wrong. And those in Israel weren't putting up much resistance to this. Neither the leaders nor the people were returning to the Lord. In our own day, how quick we can be to imagine that if only we had more honest and more honorable leaders, then we'd have a more honest and more honorable nation. But that isn't all dependent upon just the head and the tail. See there in verse 17, the Lord's purpose in cutting off the leaders of Israel. The Lord will take no pleasure in the young men, nor will he pity the fatherless and the widows, for everyone is ungodly and wicked. Every mouth speaks folly. The Lord's intervention will expose just how deep set the rot has become. It has permeated all of society. All are culpable. Because of Israel's godlessness, the Lord will leave them leaderless. Yet for all this, his anger is not turned away. His hand is still upraised. That brings us to the third turn of the downward spiral, beginning there in verse 18. With their spiritual diagnosis disclosed, Israel's perilous situation is now exposed. So often our thinking about sin sees it as little more than harmless fun. Well, even if it isn't always fun, it is never harmless. Some of us may be very aware of how our sin has paid out its wages in our own life. What we're often less aware of is how our sin pays out its wages in other people's lives. And eventually, sin always pays out its wages in full. Here in verses 18 to 21, the picture painted is of a fire out of control. A fire which scorches, consumes, devours, and feeds upon everyone in its wake. It's a bleak picture of destruction in which no one walks away unharmed. Some of us may be thinking, well, if there is a problem with sin and wickedness, it isn't a problem for me. I know myself that in some areas, I might be the last person to recognize sin in my own life. But for any of us who struggle with the diagnosis, here's the place to start. Look at your effect on people around you. All sin either directly or indirectly harms those around us. We may be aware of how some sin consumes us. All sin in some way feeds upon and devours, taking away from and leaving others less because of it. Look closely at how others may be being burned by you, and you may be surprised at what comes to light. See there in verse 19 how the Lord intervenes in the face of Israel's rampant sin. By the wrath of the Lord Almighty, the land will be scorched, and the people will be fuel for the fire. They will not spare one another. Notice how the Lord's anger is expressed here. It isn't expressed by his intervening, but by his not intervening. He leaves the people to themselves, to let their sin run on unchecked. He leaves the people in their sin for it to pay out its wages in full to their destruction. Friends, the fall of that is surely a dreadful one. Because of Israel's sinfulness, the Lord will leave them to self-destruction. Yet, for all this, his anger is not turned away. His hand is still upraised. We come now to the fourth turn of this downward spiral. It is also the very final turn, because with this, Israel will hit rock bottom. Beginning there at the start of chapter 10. The Lord who Isaiah saw, high and exalted, must, because he sits as judge on his throne of judgment, be the God of justice. And if there's anything that he then really, really opposes, it must be injustice. There could be few greater affronts to this God than those in Israel who had sat themselves high and exalted upon thrones of injustice. See how it was from verse 1. Woe to those who make unjust laws, to those who issue oppressive decrees, to deprive the poor of their rights and withhold justice from the oppressed of my people, making widows their prey, and robbing the fatherless. We've seen already that the blame for the state of the nation of Israel can't simply be laid at the feet of the leaders. The rot had permeated right through that society. So when it came to the making of unjust laws, everyone was culpable. After all, for every person who is disadvantaged by any law that has been made, there are many more who benefit from it, and who, for the most part, wants to upset that balance. Whether they're in Samaria or here in London, some troubling imbalances tend to remain in human society, however many centuries pass. In many societies, people have no opportunity to vote through any meaningful changes to its laws. But even in societies where people do have a voice, few are unlikely to vote through any laws that are not going to advantage them personally, least of all any laws which would disadvantage them personally. So the poor remain deprived of their rights, and the oppressed go without justice. Here in Great Britain, we might like to think we're strides ahead when it comes to addressing this, but we mustn't be too quick to exempt ourselves from the weight of these verses. For example, from the recognition that the gap between the richest and the poorest is ever widening in this land, to the ease with which we can always pick up a bargain when we indulge in a bit of retail therapy. This should alert us that some unjust laws are in play. Laws we may not have made, but laws we certainly benefit from. See there in verse 3 how the Lord intervenes in the face of Israel's injustice. What will you do on the day of reckoning when disaster comes from afar? To whom will you run for help? Where will you leave your riches? Nothing will remain but to cringe among the captives or fall among the slain. The Lord is bringing a day of reckoning upon Israel. He is bringing the king of Assyria, who will lay waste the land, carrying the people off into captivity. Israel will be without any allies to help. No one will plead their rights or object to the way they are being oppressed. Their treatment at the hands of Assyria will seem utterly unjust. But that's the point. Because of Israel's injustice, the Lord will leave them without justice. Yet, for all this, his anger is not turned away. His hand is still upraised. It's bleak. Is there no end to it? In the verses that follow, the focus will move from Israel to Assyria. God's anger moving from one to the other. Israel gets to breathe, but perhaps not for long. The question remains, will the Lord's hand be upon Israel to lift up or to pull down? The same question remains for us. Will the Lord's hand be upon us to exalt or to humble? Israel, in its pride, godlessness, sinfulness, and injustice, they could hardly expect anything other than humiliation and destruction. Yet is there a way for the Lord's anger to be spent, for his hand to be upraised no longer? There is. Later in Isaiah, in chapter 52, we read of the Lord's servant, one who will be raised and lifted up and highly exalted, one who will be seated upon a throne of judgment, but not as we would expect. This throne of judgment will be a wooden cross. In the next chapter, Isaiah 53, we read that this servant was pierced for our transgressions, was crushed for our iniquities. The punishment that brought us peace was on him, and by his wounds we are healed. This servant is the judge, his hand upraised, no longer to enact judgment upon Israel, but with his hands nailed to the cross, freely taking that judgment upon himself. All Israel's pride, godlessness, sinfulness, and injustice, Jesus Christ takes it upon himself. Why? That his own demand for justice would be met. And at the cross, it is met to the full. But there's more. This servant is the judge judged in our place. Yes, even us, the punishment for all our pride, godlessness, sinfulness, and injustice, no different to that of Israel, was on him. So, at the cross, only at the cross, we see hands upraised, but no longer in anger. Jesus' hands are now outstretched to lift up and exalt all those who come to him, bowed down in all humility. Just as this Lord is exalted and secure on high, so are all who turn and put their trust in him. What will such people look like? Here's a snapshot of the heights they will occupy. No longer full of pride, they will instead be humble in their approach to life. No longer godless, they will instead be godlike in their way of life. No longer sinful, they will be righteous in their pursuits in life. No longer unjust, they will be just in directing their life. To put that more simply, they will be holy. We will be holy people. The good news of God's judgment is that Israel need not end in the dust. Neither need we, for that matter. Together, in the Lord's hand, we can find ourselves lifted to new heights, the very greatest heights of living. May it be so for us here this evening. Amen.